Show. Follow me online on Parler at Jackie Daily Show on Instagram and on Facebook, and subscribe for free most places where quality podcasts are found. All right, coming up this show, I will speak with my friend, Texas Railroad Commissioner Wayne Christian, and he's going to talk about this new pilot program where if you are an individual or business that owes capital gains taxes, you can either cut your check to Uncle Sam or you can cut your check to an energy education program that teaches the truth about oil and gas. It's at Stephen F. Austin University. It's part of the Opportunity Zones that the federal government has rolled out. You might know Scott Turner, former NFL player, turned Texas legislator, now working for the Trump administration in these Opportunity Zones program. So, I mean, it sounds great to me. Why give the money to the government and let it do what it wants with it when you could get a credit by helping out this program in East Texas? So we'll talk more about that, and then we'll speak with Tyler Corder. He is with the Texas Public Policy Foundation's Leadership Liberty Council, and this is essentially the younger generation, right? These are the young leaders that are being raised up to take the place when the baton is passed from the leaders of this generation. So they're under 40, very impressive. He's written up a piece in Bloomberg Law, and it's titled Insight: Environmental Groups Should Embrace Pipelines, Not Cancel Them. And he makes a very compelling case for why pipelines are actually the greenest option and the safest option to get the energy that we need. The other options are rail or truck. And you have to also understand, and Tyler makes the case, look, fossil fuels are not optional. Most of the activists who do these protests believe that if they'll just protest enough, litigate enough, make it expensive enough for energy companies to operate, that the oil or natural gas will stay in the ground. They call it the keep it in the ground movement, and that we're all going to use, you know, all renewables, and that's their plan. They don't understand that fossil fuels are here to stay. The Energy Information Administration, a U.S. government agency, and the International Energy Agency in Paris both project that by 2040, we will still be using about 70% fossil fuels to fuel the globe. So that, I think, is the critical key piece that is missing for these groups. I think they really don't understand that. Or they're just rent a crowd, right? They don't understand. They don't care what they don't understand. They're there to make money. Sometimes those protests are rented crowds. But Tyler makes a very, you know, the reasoned case for people who are serious about this issue, assuming good faith on the part of the protesters. And he explains why they're on the wrong side of this, if they're on the side of the environment. And so I thought he did a really, really impressive job. I also speak to my friend Bill Peacock, who is with the Energy Alliance. And he lays out what is essentially an electricity tax on Texans. I mean, they hit you every way you're coming and going, right? You pay an income tax, you're paying property tax, sales tax, sin tax. You might pay a death tax if you're worth a certain amount. Well, now you're paying an electricity tax. And what's so upsetting about this is that the commissioners here in Texas on the Public Utility Commission put together this tax, you know, over in some agency rather than in the legislature, to basically correct a problem from all the subsidies that they put up against in favor of renewable energy. So they create a problem by doing poor policy with your money, $19 billion of it since 2006. Texans have paid, and now, because they're in trouble, they hit you with a tax. So they spent your money and messed that up, so now they're going to spend more of it. This is the stuff that drives me bananas. So you would never know about it unless people like Bill Peacock and the Energy Alliance pulled it out of the public record and put it together in a digestible form. They have a brand new report that explains this. And, you know, like he says to me, they had to really dig to find this stuff. They don't do the calculations for you. You know, you have to go through, pull out this administration information. It's like reading the U.S. Federal Register. Talk about boring. Almost no one does that, and they know that. That's why all the dirty work is done in the dark corners of these administrative agencies instead of in the legislature, because you would actually notice that, and your representative would vote. And if you didn't like it, you would hold them accountable and unelect them. Well, good luck trying to unelect a commissioner at the Public Utility Commission. Chances are very high. You don't even know their names. Who does, right? So they're impossible to even barely identify. You'd have to go do some Google searching for that, let alone you can't get to them, right? You can't unelect them. So you get stuck with the worst policy choices, and so much of it is administrative. Shameful. Needs to stop. Okay, then I'm going to go through some research from the Texas Public Policy Foundation, where they contrast the Trump energy policy with the Biden energy policy. It's probably difficult to find a more stark contrast. So if you look at polls, energy and environment issues are the most polarized. I mean, other issues have not come close. You might think it would be abortion or race relations or immigration that are most polarized, but no. At least not up until the recent riots. Okay, things have gotten worse lately. Maybe now race relations are up there with climate change, but I don't know. It would be difficult to see such a divide. It's almost to the point that you tell me what you believe about climate change, and I can tell you who you're voting for in November. I mean, that's how bad it is. It proves it's not really about science anymore. If it were, there wouldn't be such a partisan divide. It's about politics, and it always has been. So I'll get to that later in the show. And I have promised that I will say each week, as a public service announcement for Goodwill Industries, that, as you might know, charities like Goodwill get hurt by things like the COVID-19 shutdown, because they are a charity and they rely on people coming to their stores and shopping, but they had to close the stores during COVID. So I'm on the board, and here in North Texas, what's going to happen is that they will use North Texas Giving Day, which is very big here, September 17th, as their big annual fundraiser to try to make up the difference for COVID-19. But if you're not a Texan or a North Texan, you can help Goodwill wherever you are just by donating your household goods. So donations, as you know, are the lifeblood of Goodwill. And here's the deal. This isn't just a store where people go if they're low income and need goods for not a lot of money. It's a lot more than that. Goodwill is actually a jobs program. It's a jobs program for people who have physical disabilities, mental disabilities. Maybe they've been incarcerated in the past and they need an opportunity, but they're disqualified from a lot of jobs because of a criminal record. Maybe they're people who have never been in the workforce before. So, literally, people who come out of a multi-generational entitlement background and now they want to break that cycle and enter the workforce and become productive members of society. There's job training for them, and there's a special focus on them. So that's what Goodwill does. It takes people who otherwise might not be able to find a job and be productive members of society and gives them a place to do that and to find that opening and that opportunity. So that's why supporting Goodwill is so important. It really, really improves lives. Last year, just in North Texas, where I am here, Goodwill served 5,000 people with job training and placed over 1,500 into jobs. People who weren't working before are working now, and that's success. So again, if you're here, or even if you're not, online North Texas Giving Day, you can give money. But what you can do and should do is just donate your gently used household items to Goodwill anytime and help them out in what's been a tough year. Here's a word from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which works to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org, lifepowered.org. And you know, I have a steady stream of Life Powered experts and content on the show each week because just like my show, Life Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block of this economy that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to the kitchen table. Check them out, lifepowered.org. All right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Jackie Daily Show. Listen, last week I began giving you just some contrast between what would a Trump presidency reelect mean for oil and gas, and what would a Biden presidency mean for oil and gas. I had like literally a 7-page analysis on this from the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and I think I got a page and a half into it after 10 minutes of talking. So there's so much here, so much to know, and I barely even scratched the surface. Here's the deal. There are a lot of people out there working in oil and gas who think, you know, they're maybe from Union Democrat families. They think that the Democrats will be good for the working man. They think that, their grandpa voted Democrat, their dad voted Democrat, so they're going to vote Democrat. And that if they don't, it's disloyalty almost to their own people. So I certainly came from a family like that. I understand it. And so here's the deal. What has happened over the last 20 or 30 years is very different. It's no longer, I don't care what anyone says, it's no longer about this party is for wealthy people, this party is for working people. And I don't know that it really ever was. But there was a time when the Democrat Party was certainly the party of unions. Today, you know what? It depends. If you are in a union that works with its hands, that is physical labor, right? You're a plumber, a pipe fitter, you are an operator, you know, maybe even the auto industry. Don't be so sure that you can know or have a knee-jerk reaction about which party is in your best interest. Because what happened last election, particularly in my home state of Ohio, is you had this fracking revolution. So all of these guys who work construction had this huge boom in jobs. They were ecstatic. But then the anti-oil and gas people came along and were protesting and trying to ban fracking every time you turn around, especially near Youngstown and areas like that. And these guys are saying, wait a minute, these are our jobs. This is what's keeping us alive in terms of our job. But nobody cared. What they found out was that these days, environmental issues will trump, pardon the pun, will predominate over labor, right? Labor comes second. Carbon emissions come first. That wouldn't have been true 30 years ago at all. It's true today. It's just a very big change. And a lot of people were kind of slow to come along with it. But, you know, in the Ohio River Valley, particularly, there you're talking about some serious states for the election. Ohio, Pennsylvania, and then Indiana and Kentucky, West Virginia. You know, that has been a major transitional region. When I was growing up, it was solidly Union Democrat in all those pockets along the river. The old steel mills, factories, you know, railroads, coal mines. My, how things have changed. So it's no longer this way. You can't just take for granted anymore that you know which party's on your side. If you are about oil and gas, I have to say, your country has become the number one producer of oil and gas on Earth. On Earth. Because of the shale revolution. Now, President Trump had nothing to do with the shale revolution, okay? That was done by thousands of oil and gas workers and companies and CEOs. But he got out of the way rolled back the Obama-era regulations and really permitted it to just explode and flourish. And so, you know, we're number one. We're no longer dependent on OPEC. We may maybe get 10% of our oil or so from OPEC. It used to be like 70% that we imported. So things have really changed, for the good. Now, so you understand exactly the difference. Here we have Joe Biden saying this, quote, no more drilling on federal lands. No more drilling, including offshore. No ability for the oil industry to continue to drill, period, and no new fracking. Fracking, he means hydraulic fracturing. Those of us who are in this space know. And so you understand, if you don't frack, I mean, that's like 90% of the wells in America. Like, it's over. The whole industry goes away. This is not just kind of sort of nibbling at the edges. I mean, in this country, we frack. And if you don't frack, perhaps nothing comes out of that well. Or certainly it's not economical. And so this would destroy the industry as we know it that employs 10 million people. Now, I'm not telling you how to vote. You know, there are plenty of people out there who would happily sacrifice the oil and gas industry for what they think is a gain environmentally from not having any production. Of course, what would really happen in real life is that we would just import it from somewhere else. This country is not going to stop using 20 million barrels of oil a day. And the people who are seemingly pro-environment are just, you know, as big offenders as anyone else. Their lifestyles are just as lavish or more lavish. In fact, they tend to be kind of upper middle class. And so they can burn through more goods and resources than the rest of us. Okay, what else might Joe Biden want for your future? He will reverse the Trump regulatory reforms, which were a reversal of the Obama regulatory reforms, right? He will move the country on a path to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. He's announcing a $2 trillion plan that you will pay for that will spread money across the energy sector, picking winners and losers. And by the way, if he says $2 trillion, what do we know about government spending? It's always, I mean, a multiple of what they promise. If he says $2 trillion, plan on 10, okay? Like, remember when they said the income tax would never go above 10%? Of course you don't remember that. That was way back in the early part of the last century to finance wars. What a lie that was. Are you paying 10% income tax? I'm not. Of course, the people who make those promises are all dead now, conveniently, which is how government works. They make promises and then they're dead by the time the bill comes due. And pardon me, but candidate Biden might not make it as long as other people who made promises. Let's be serious, right? The man is not well. All right, what else? He will re-engage on international commitments to reduce carbon emissions, none of which can be practically enforced. Things like the Paris Climate Agreement. He promises to spend $400 billion of your money on underwriting clean energy technology, which means advanced nuclear reactors and other things. He will make household appliances and businesses more energy efficient. Remember the dishwashers and washing machines that get the little gold star or whatever for their energy efficiency? Okay, when I first moved to Texas, I bought washing machine and dryer. I didn't notice that they were energy efficient. They didn't get my clothes clean. They fill up halfway. You have to like do twice as much work to get the clothes clean. So guess what? I sold them within like a week and bought new. Really. All right, so what else? He adopts a whole of government approach to environmental justice. What he means is open season on job-killing lawsuits backed by federal agencies. That's what that means. Translating again, when they say whole of government approach to environmental justice, they're talking about job-killing lawsuits backed by federal agencies. They will also enact a carbon tax through regulation while holding corporate officials personally responsible for violating climate pollution rules with prison time. Prison time. CEOs, are you listening? Board members, are you listening? If you have a fiduciary duty, you probably are in the crosshairs. They're talking about throwing you into a cage for what they claim is climate pollution. By the way, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It's not a pollutant. But anyway, they would create, they say, 10 million union jobs. And by the way, that claim is highly questionable. It doesn't mention the millions of jobs that would be destroyed in oil, gas, and coal industries. And finally, they would make coal companies pay more into the government's Black Lung Benefits Program. And that's just another way to increase the cost of producing coal. President Trump has referred to the Green New Deal as the, quote, nearly $100 trillion Green New Deal disaster, which would ban oil and gas leasing on all federal lands with no fracking, unquote. $100 trillion? I'd say that's closer to the truth. Trillion with a T. There's no way we're paying for that. Also, there's no way people are putting up with the policy. Look at California with rolling blackouts. I wonder how long people will hold up under things like rolling blackouts until they begin to question the claims that have been made and the promises made by the people who make the promises. Again, I'm not telling you who to vote for. I would never do that. But I do think you should know the truth. Some of you might like what Joe Biden is saying. I don't know. Many of you won't. I just thought you should hear it all, because it will be glossed over. They will put lipstick on this pig between now and November, but I give it to you raw. All right, taking a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Follow me online at jackiedaily.com, on Facebook, and on Parler at Jackie Daily Show. You know already that you pay income taxes, sales taxes, depending on your vices, if you have them, maybe sin taxes. Do you know that you pay also an electricity tax? I mean, if they didn't get you enough, right? Property taxes, death taxes, there's a tax for everything. Everything. Well, in states like Texas, which so often are upheld as the model somehow for the rest of the country, you should know we're not perfect. We pay a big fat electricity tax here, and most people don't know it, but a lot of states do. My friend Bill Peacock at the Energy Alliance has released a report over there, or the Alliance has released a report laying out exactly what this is. It's $3.6 billion price tag to us so far. And so, Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jackie. It's great to be on, as always.
Well, Bill, you never disappoint. I'm going to pull one of your quotes right out of this press release in front of me. It says, quote, Texans are paying generators an extra $3.6 billion for electricity because Texas policymakers won't stand up to the renewable energy lobby, unquote. That's a great quote. Okay, explain that, because people around the country are probably surprised that here in Texas that's the case.
Well, it's unfortunately not just in Texas that these kinds of things are happening. And at the bottom, below all the, whatever's happening up on the surface, the cause is renewable energy subsidies, right? And policymakers across the country won't take on the renewable energy lobby. They're afraid of it, maybe, or they just don't want to stand up to them, or they believe in all that. Whatever it is, basically, those folks have complete access to whatever resources Texas have. And let's put it, resources that Texas citizens have. And in this case, in Texas, it's an increase in the cost of electricity. So what happens when you have renewable energy subsidies? In Texas this year, they're running about $2.3 billion, federal, state, and local subsidies going to renewable energy generators. And because of that, they don't really care what price they sell their electricity for. all they care about is getting their electricity into the market, because that's how they qualify for their federal subsidies. And so they sell prices, you know, the electricity as low as they need to get it onto the market. Well, that depresses the price, and that has reduced income to traditional reliable generators like natural gas and coal and nuclear. And so they're not investing in new generation in Texas like they should be because of the depressed prices. Well, Texas policymakers had a chance last session. There are a lot of bills introduced to do something about this, and they refused to do anything about it. And so the Texas Public Utility Commission had to do something, but rather than try and take on the subsidies directly, and in one level, you can hardly blame them since their bosses in the legislature and in the governor's mansion and stuff wouldn't do it. They just decided to increase the cost of electricity. In this case, last year, it cost $3.6 billion, as you mentioned. And then that money goes straight to generators. And the idea is that these generators, particularly natural gas, will get that money and build new generation that'll keep us from having to rely so much on wind and solar, which are causing all the reliability problems. But that doesn't seem to be happening so far.
Okay, so I think I just heard you say that after we paid all these billions in subsidies to renewable energy, the commissioners, seeing a problem, created a new electricity tax. So the solution for this problem is just more money, right?
So the solution for the harm caused by subsidies is another subsidy.
Yeah, that's what it looks like from what I'm reading here. So of course, these commissioners, they don't feel any pushback for that. I mean, what Texan knows? I mean, if you polled 100 Texans right now, how many of them know this is going on? Probably very few.
Well, almost none. And it's really interesting. This is an administrative price adder that this happens. And so all the data on this is in these obscure documents generated online by the ERCOT, who manages the grid, and at the Public Utility Commission. And so they don't even publish this number. Right? You have to go in and do the calculation.
I don't blame them.
So we have at the Energy Alliance, and we've done that and put that number out there. But recently, in the last month, I've submitted two requests to the Public Utility Commission because they get reports on a daily and monthly basis that have some of these costs in there, some of the data that is needed to determine these costs. And the requests were denied from the Public Utility Commission because they said they're exempt from the Public Information Act because of various legal reasons. So we can't even get this information in real time today, and it'll be October, November before they publish the information so that we can actually make the calculations.
Okay. I'm so used to hearing that excuse of, hey, we don't have to be transparent and hand over the information, from my time in Washington, D.C., where, you know, normally you would hear something like that from, like, the FBI or the CIA,
right,
or the Department of Defense, because they would say, you know, that's a state secret, or it would compromise national security for us to hand that information over to you. It's classified, it's sensitive, whatever. This is the Public Utility Commission. I mean, this is the people, right, who set rates and do things like, you know, tax us for electricity. How can they have an excuse hide behind?
Right. I mean, as you pointed out earlier, this is the Texas Public Utility Commission. We would expect in Texas to not see this kind of problem. But the truth of the matter is that nobody, and it's not just the Public Utility Commissioners. Like I said, the Texas legislature has had ample opportunity to deal with this, and they haven't. But just imagine this scenario. Instead of the PUC doing this, the Texas legislature had come in last session and passed a $3.6 billion electricity tax. You know, the whole world would have gone bonkers over that. But because they stuffed this down in an agency where nobody's paying attention, then they can get away with it. It kind of reminds me of what's going on out in California, with all these with the rolling blackouts out there, right? Everybody's wandering around. Governor Newsom out there is going, "Hey, how did this happen? This is unacceptable for California. We're going to get to the bottom of this." Well, all they have to do is look at the weather forecast and find out that when the rolling blackouts started, the wind wasn't blowing.
Right. Well, and which is exactly what they, you know, this is what they wanted. This is the regime they wanted. And I will say, I'm almost out of time for this segment, but this is, at least there, you get your governor talking. As you said, here, we have these agencies doing things to us, just like in Washington, where, in my mind, from what I've seen, that's where the dirty work is done. Because they know nobody's watching. You know, like, the right. legislature is like a theater. And it really is. I mean, I worked for a Judiciary Committee, the most theatrical and mean and nasty of all the committees. It's a big show. It's a total show. In fact, one of the top staffers would say, "Hey, people, don't get excited. This is just theater. Keep your powder dry." And that would just grind on my nerves. But that's true. And so while we're over here putting on a show with witnesses and it's all choreographed, the dirty work is done in the agencies where you're not watching. You don't know the names of those people. You might know the name of, you know, Ted Cruz or Kamala Harris. You don't know the name of your public utility commissioner. They're so insulated from any responsibility. So I'm going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Bill Peacock, who is heading up the Energy Alliance as the policy director. And we will go back to California because you need to know what's going on with the rolling blackouts in California. It's like as if they're a world country or something. It's real. Here's a word from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which works to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org, lifepowered.org. And you know, I have a steady stream of Life Powered experts and content on the show each week because just like my show, Life Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block of this economy that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to the kitchen table. Check them out, lifepowered.org. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. We're back with Bill Peacock, and he is the policy director over at the Energy Alliance. If you're just joining us, in the last segment we talked about the new report from the Alliance, which shows you what you would never know otherwise, which is that in the case of Texas, our Public Utility Commission hits us with this big tax. Why? Because of mistakes they made hitting us with subsidies. You pay and then you pay again to cover up their mistakes. So Bill explains that, you know, how many billions of dollars Texans have kicked out and now in some dark shadows of a building in Austin in an agency, they cook up a plan for us to pay more, to bail out essentially problems from renewable energy. Well, how about California? We see rolling blackouts. The state deserves it. They make such terrible, terrible policy ideas become reality that this was about to or bound to happen. The rubber's finally hit the road in California. And Bill, I've been wondering, when are things going to get bad enough with, renewable energy and rolling blackouts for people to see through the promises that have been made that aren't real? And I think California is our first real example of what this looks like. I feel like we're seeing it play out before our eyes at a most inopportune time because it is the Democrat National Committee convention right now. And of course, the policies in California were those endorsed by Kamala Harris. So we can kind of see what her vision looks like. So, Bill, explain what went wrong in California. Why is there a blackout? Blackouts, plural.
Well, they have been pushing renewable energy out in California for years, just about as long as Texas has. They're a little ahead of the game. And what they've done more recently is they're gunning for 100% renewable out there in California. Texas hasn't gone that far. We've taken a different, more free market approach, but it's a more market-based approach, let me put it that way. But they're just putting the mandates on mandates and mandates. And so they hate coal out there, and so they're retiring every coal plant they can get their hands on out there. And so more and more and more, it's wind and solar, but wind is dominating the grid. And it's not, and of course, they're not just the California grid. It's a whole western part of the country grid. And so it's not just hurting California. It's also extending out there. But when you rely on wind, it only works if the wind is blowing. And particularly on hot summer afternoons, when the temperatures are rising, the wind tends to slow down or even stop. And that's the bottom line. And so we'll never be able to get enough wind to make us 100% renewable. And that's what they're beginning to experience out there right now.
Well, they would respond that they're on top of this because, after all, they're stocking up on batteries to store the wind energy for when the wind doesn't blow. I've heard it over and over and over. What would you say to that?
Well, it's kind of like we were talking about earlier. So the response from the PUC in Texas was to the problems caused by a subsidy was another subsidy. Well, here out in California, they're talking about the response to the high cost of renewable energy is to make it even more expensive by adding batteries into the mix. Right? I mean, so you have this reliability problem with renewable energy. It just doesn't work. And so it starts adding all these costs. And so what do you do to make it work? Well, you just add more costs. We're going to store stuff in batteries. But the cost of doing that is astronomical. And if we thought windmills were expensive, why do we see batteries put in place out there? It's just not feasible from an economic standpoint. And it's very problematic even from a technical standpoint.
Yeah, so I saw some research from my friend Brent Bennett over at Texas Public Policy Foundation. He said he went to the Energy Information Administration, which is, you know, the national kind of repository for energy information. And he found that if you took all of the United States battery storage capability, you could run the city of New York for less than an hour on it.
Right. they did this in Australia. And they've got some of Australia has markets somewhat like Texas, not as robust, but when it comes to electricity. But one of them decided they are going all in on renewables. And so they bought this big battery out there to put in place in case they ran across times of scarcity that they could put it in. And so it got hot in the afternoon. The wind was coming down, and so they started the battery going. Well, the battery ran out before it got to the peak demand, right? And so it wasn't even there when they really needed it.
So what happened? The Australians just had no power?
Well, they had some problems. I think there were some blackouts down there as well on that one. So it none of this works. I mean, but you asked the question earlier, how bad does it have to get? Well, the problem is, even when it gets really bad, the public aren't going to hear the truth, right?
Right.
Because, for instance, what happened when it came to Russia interfering with our elections? Well, it turned out it wasn't Russia, it was the Democrats, but the public never heard that, right? And it's going to be the same thing with renewable energy. And what we really need are some leaders who have the power to get to the public around the media to make these decisions and make this information out there. And so we need people like that, because the public's not going to get it through the media.
No, maybe we need someone who runs to Parler or Instagram, like the president runs to social media, to tell everyone and get around the press
right,
what's really going on. And that takes courage, and that takes someone who doesn't take money from renewable energy in their PACs or whatever.
Right.
And I think those people are few and far between. Certainly, they give to both parties liberally, and they've got the money to do so. Wonder where they got that, you know?
From us.
Yeah, exactly, from us in the first place. So I saw a layout recently of all the people who bundled money for Barack Obama in his election, and they were the big winners in the energy grants, Solyndra, and those types of things. So kind of keep your eye on the revolving door inside the government. We're talking with Bill Peacock. He is the policy director over at the Energy Alliance, which you can find at theenergyalliance.com. And Bill tells the truth. You can trust Bill. If Bill writes it, it's true. If Bill tweets it, it's true. If he says it, it's true. Trust Bill Peacock. I do. Bill, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Jackie. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. Here's a word from the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which exists to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but on this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org. Again, lifepowered.org. I have a steady stream of Life Powered experts and content on this show each week, because just like my show, Life Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to our kitchen table. Energy fuels what is possible, the freedom to go where we want, live where we choose, and enjoy the things that we love most. Human flourishing depends on energy use, often in invisible and unnoticed ways. Reliable energy supply can feed the hungry, take care of the sick, and ensure a prosperous economic future for all of us. It promotes freedom and independence around the world and here at home. And fossil fuels don't just power your car and heat your home. They are the building blocks of 60% of all fibers and 100% of all plastics. They're used to create the fertilizers that produce food for half of the world. The U.S. has the means to lead the world in energy production. Through our ingenuity and innovation, responsible production of reliable energy will make the world safer, the environment cleaner, and each and every one of us more prosperous. If you want to know more about how this works, check it out, lifepowered.org. That's lifepowered.org. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. You can follow me on Instagram and on Parler, the free speech alternative to Twitter. And always subscribe for free. iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spotify, and many others. All right. I'm so lucky because I have my favorite Texas Railroad Commissioner, Wayne Christian, on the line. And he is an amazing showman. He gives amazing speeches. I've had to follow him before. It's very painful for me. He's awesome, a Fox News star, on my show many times, does great radio, and he's a star gospel singer. A lot of people don't know that. He is joining me to talk about two things today. Number one, opportunity zones, which you might not know a lot about, but there isn't a big oil and gas angle here, and jobs out in the oil patch. It has been a tough year, a super tough year for oil and gas. And a lot of people are kind of wondering, where are we? How are things going out there? And so Wayne is an optimist, and he's going to tell us. He has some really good news, I think. As the man who leads up the Texas Energy Education and Workforce Development Initiative. So he's in the know. So Wayne, welcome back to the show.
Honored to be with you, Jackie. And you brag about my talking. My wife always tells me hot air is cheap. That's about what I'm worth, okay?
I've never heard that, but I might have to borrow that and cite to Mrs. Christian, hot air is cheap. So, okay, so we were talking earlier while I was joining you on your meeting that you lead, not semi-annually, it's a little more than that, but regularly, Texas Energy Education and Workforce Development Initiative, you mentioned that if you have capital gains taxes that you owe, you have an option. You can either pay them to Uncle Sam, or you can pay them toward to essentially opportunity zones, opportunities where you do energy and specifically oil and gas education and workforce development. So explain that option.
Well, of course, what we've done, Jackie, is develop a energy school. We found out when I first became railroad commissioner that one of the biggest hindrances to the oil and gas business was lack of labor, from truck drivers, welders, all the way to petroleum engineering. And all of our schools are full. We're producing as many as our system possibly can. So we needed additional employees at every level of the oil and gas industry. So I started working with the group that you're with, our task force I organized on employees and how to create employees for the oil and gas industry. We've gone through many different ideas, but mainly we found that we needed instruction and we need the techniques to do that with, teach people how to work in the oil and gas business. We found that, of course, building a campus was kind of expensive, but President Trump appointed Representative Scott Turner from Texas, former state representative, as the director of the Opportunity Zones. And Brooks Rawlings from the Texas Public Policy Foundation is the number one advisor from the Trump administration. And what an Opportunity Zone does is across the United States, the governors designate underserved areas. A lot of these are inner cities, but there's a lot in rural America and rural Texas. The advantages to these is if you have an Opportunity Zone project and you want to invest in Opportunity Zone, individuals, companies, whoever, while there are billions of dollars available in government grants that everybody goes after, the Opportunity Zone dollars are available, capital gains taxes, which are trillions of dollars in the United States. Capital gains taxes, if you owe any as an individual or as a company or corporation, if you write the check to the federal government, of course, you spend those dollars in taxes and never see anything but government programs. But you have the option of writing a check to a program in an opportunity zone, of which our energy school I have established in a rural underserved area in Deep East Texas, and it you get 100% tax credit toward those capital gains taxes. In other words, if you want to write the check to Uncle Sam, God bless you. I don't understand people like that. But if you want to write it to education, people having jobs in the energy sector, then we have a place that you can write that check to instead of Uncle Sam. And if it stays there over a 10-year period, it's 100% forgiven, which is a total tax credit, not a deduction. So it's a marvelous opportunity for folks to write a check to public education in our energy school that we've established, and it go 100% to the school into education and scholarships and buildings for energy training.
That's awesome. And I think I know a lot of people and companies here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area alone who would be interested in doing that, who could totally benefit. So if they want to take advantage, who do they contact? Where do they call?
Well, of course, just contact my office and we'll give you full instructions on that. My office phone number is 512-463-7131. That's 512-463-7131. We'll give you full information on how you can write a check to a good education group for getting workers for the energy industry. And we need the different corporations and businesses to come to us and say, what courses are you needing in this comeback? You know, what's neat, Jackie, is that we have a terrible downturn and we have tens of thousands of people that have been laid off work. The good news is that the industry is now rebounding in a V-shaped curve rather than a U-shaped slow curve. And very soon you're going to see the demand for oil and gas exceed the production, which means that the companies will be revving back up and trying to hire people. Also, there's companies like British Petroleum and others are doing contracts with artificial intelligence companies, developing new techniques, new career opportunities in the oil and gas industry. And we are on board to try to how to teach people, train people to get on board this large increase in population. The jobs are phenomenal. One company says we're over 100,000 short nationwide. Texas alone was 30,000 jobs short prior to the downturn. Now it's 40,000 because of the downturn.
And when you say jobs short, what you mean is people needed.
People right. needed jobs yeah. needed at salaries that the neat thing about the little school we had, just to give you an example, what we're put together was a community college that was creating an energy school. The people that graduated that energy school were 92% employed after 2 years at five-figure incomes from rural underserved Texas. They could not advance in the careers in their particular companies because they didn't have a four-year diploma. So the local four-year educational facility, Stephen F. Austin, in this rural area, takes and accepts 100% of the hours of the two-year program, and online allows these workers from the field to complete the last 2 years. What you wind up with is a four-year degree with no debt, with potential six-figure income. I'll put that up anywhere in the nation against a bunch of liberal arts degrees that you can't get a job and wind up with school debt.
That's amazing. When I hear something that impressive, I have to repeat it. You said six-figure income, potentially, and no debt. And no debt. Because, I mean, this generation is really enslaved to its educational debt. There are so many people out there right now, whether they have worthless degrees, to be frank, or even good degrees, who are under six figures of debt rather than six figures of income, who would love to be in that position. So if someone is listening and they need a job, or their child or grandchild needs a job in the energy sector, how do they get involved with the Stephen F. Austin program?
Well, of course, you can just give our office a call and we'll forward that number on to Stephen F. Austin Admission. I don't have that number here, but again, our number is 512-463-7131 is our Railroad Commission office, and we can certainly get you in touch with the admissions office. Our school isn't really started yet, so it'd be great to get on the ground floor of this. We've got the buildings that have been donated by the industry. The equipment is being donated by the industry. And it's amazing. We're going to wind up with a public institution that was not donated by an individual alumni, that sometimes good folks do that. But this is a public institution, Jackie, in a year that we're going to be down in tax revenue for the state, that is being donated without taxpayer funding for a for a public institution. I think it's a great work of when you have the public and the private industry come together with education and create a no-cost, paid-for facility in school.
We're talking with Wayne Christian, and he is a Texas Railroad Commissioner down there in Austin. Sounds like railroad really to me means oil and gas. This is probably the top regulatory body on earth for the oil and gas industry. And Wayne is on top of workforce development like no one I know. Wayne, thanks so much for coming on.
Honor to be with you, Jackie.
You're listening to the Jackie Daly Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Follow me online at jackiedaly.com and subscribe for free. iHeartRadio podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, and most other places where quality podcasts are found. And you can listen KWEL Midland Odessa 107.1 FM 1070 AM. Well, we've watched the anti-pipeline activists celebrating the cancellation of so many pipelines. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline, before that Dakota Access Pipeline, before that Keystone XL Pipeline. And this proves, according to Tyler Corder, who is a member of the Texas Public Policy Foundation's Liberty Leadership Council, that these groups need a refresher course on energy. They just don't understand. They're making a big mistake. So Tyler has been generous with his time and agreed to come on the show and explain this as part of a piece he wrote for Bloomberg Law, by the way. You can find it there. Insight: environmental groups should embrace pipelines, not cancel them. Tyler, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jackie. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. And explain this, Tyler. What is it they don't understand about pipelines?
Yeah, absolutely, Jackie. So there's the big buzzword now. Everyone's excited to hear about the energy transition, presumably transitioning to, you know, sustainable energy or green energy. But we're going to need some kind of fuel to get us there, something that we have now. And in America, what that is natural gas, and we have an abundance of it. whether it's West Virginia, which is where this pipeline was being to bring to the good folks in North Carolina from West Virginia, here in the Permian Basin. And so we have an abundance of supply. The problem is, how do we get that supply to the markets? It's you can do it through multiple means, but the overwhelming safest way of delivering the natural gas is through pipeline.
Okay, so let me stop you right there for a second, because as far as I know, the options are move crude or natural gas by pipeline. You can move it by truck. You can move it by rail. Explain why pipelines are safer than the alternatives.
Sure. Well, so first off, we can back up to the production of, you know, it depends on the well, of course. There are some wells that are predominantly natural gas or crude oil. In the past, companies have just wanted to produce crude oil with natural gas being a byproduct, but actually it's valuable. So in order for it to be transported via truck, it has to be liquefied, which can be very expensive. Whereas if you put it through a gas pipeline, it goes straight from the wellhead with minimal processing into a pipeline. Now, pipelines itself is safer because it's a continuous automated monitored 24/7 system that can span thousands of miles that really takes the human component out of it. These pipelines undergo rigorous regulatory requirements. There's various oversight boards for this kind of infrastructure. In addition to that, again, they have these monitoring systems in place and integrity programs where they're constantly evaluating the quality of the pipe, right? Detecting leaks. Over 99% of products transported via pipeline, it's almost like 99.9% make it to their final destination as opposed to trucks or other alternatives.
Yeah, so I had a friend on the show who was the former acting administrator of the Pipelines and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration. I committed to memory his statistic, which was so impressive. He said rail can transport hazardous materials from point A to point B safely 99.997% of the time. Pipelines have twice the safety record of that. That's how safe they are, generally speaking. So nothing is risk-free, but that's about as good as it gets.
Well, yeah, exactly, Jack. Exactly. You know, they're looking for, again, I mentioned this in the piece, they're looking for 100% renewable energy, or they're looking for perfection, which just does not exist. And trying to say, right, pointing to these very, 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 very few cases of oil spills or anything like that via pipeline, I mean, it's going to happen. And it's remarkable, given the thousands of miles of pipeline we have across the United States, that we have such few cases. So you can't use that as an argument not to use pipelines, that simply because there are few cases.
Right. Well, and they're always complaining about carbon emissions, right? Like, that's supposed to be the end game here, is they want to reduce carbon emissions. I would be inclined to believe, from my research, that a pipeline emits far less carbon than, say, a rail line or a truck. What do you think?
No, yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're going through, right, a pipeline, and as opposed to a truck, right, which in and of itself is going to have leakage. But, you know, even looking at, they're talking about these greenhouse gases, and that's definitely one part of the environmental picture where, you know, you produce this product, and you transport it. And so you evaluate, okay, what's the least carbon intensive means of transporting that gas? It would be, you know, you look to pipelines, right? And in the piece specifically, you know, if we're going to continue producing crude oil, right, we need to do something with the natural gas. So there are a couple of alternatives there. You can vent it, right, which is the worst thing you can do, right, because it's just letting methane go into the atmosphere. Or you can flare it, right? Or you can process it, you know, and transport it, again, via pipeline, and use it to power our cities, right, cheaply, because we have an abundance of it.
Yeah.
So if we're going to produce crude oil, it's, again, you mentioned this on your show. I listened to a couple of your episodes before coming on. We use it in every day of our lives. I mean, Life Power talks about this. Where literally you look to anything in the room you're sitting in right now, guarantee the bulk of those products are used fossil fuels. So we're going to produce it. We have to produce it. There is no, you know, all natural or what wholly renewable source outside of fossil fuels to make these things a reality. So we're going to be producing natural gas. What we do to it depends on the infrastructure we can put in place, right? Which would be pipelines.
Yeah. Well, before I move off of the green point, actually, you know, when you think about things, commodities moving in a pipeline, they move in one direction, right? From the wellhead to where we need to go, to the refinery, whatever. If you're going to move something by rail or by truck, again, now, not so much an alternative for natural gas, certainly for crude. Now, you're talking about having to go back to the well, right? Back, forth, back, forth, back, forth. So it's twice as many trips to get something moved, if I'm making sense here.
Yes.
So it's a lot more. I mean, the carbon footprint would be exponentially larger.
Yeah, right. Well, in the pipelines, you know, you call them batches. So, you know, in natural gas, obviously, there's going to be a constant flow as long as you're producing, as opposed to having to schedule trucks, right? And not only is that more cost intensive, you know, there's more human error involved in doing that. And yeah, to your point, on the green point, I mentioned this piece and I was almost hesitant to provide this as an example because trucking is necessary in some parts of the United States, which is too remote for pipelines to be justified. Yeah, in this specific case, right, West Virginia to North Carolina, pipeline would be like the most economic, greenest alternative to any other method, especially given the, you know, the different elevations in West Virginia makes trucking a little bit more dangerous.
Oh, yes. I've driven West Virginia many times because I used to live in Washington, D.C. and drive home to Ohio. We call it the West Virginia 500 because that is one treacherous state. It's just a big mountain, the whole state. So you definitely do not want to be trucking any fuel there. And I was actually on the road there once when, in the middle of a storm, there was a release by a fuel truck on the highway. And we were, you know, backed up in traffic on Thanksgiving. And I thought, if something ignites this, I'm in big trouble because you couldn't go anywhere, you know, and fuel was going everywhere. So it's kind of scary. So pipelines should be, you know, much preferable. Okay, so you wrote this up in Bloomberg Law. Again, it's titled Insight. Environmental groups should embrace pipelines, not cancel them. We're talking with Tyler Corder, who is a member of Texas Public Policy Foundation's Liberty Leadership Council out of Houston, Texas, in this case. Tyler, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jackie.
You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Jackie Daly Show. Follow us online, JackieDaly.com, on Facebook and on Twitter at Jackie Daly Show and Instagram. So you've no doubt either heard about or suffered from the unemployment numbers brought on by the COVID-19 shutdown. It was a disastrous, almost 13% jump in unemployment in the state of Texas, a state that had a great economy going into the shutdown and that really has consistently been voted one of the most hospitable states for business year after year after year. So I can only imagine what's happening in New York and Michigan. Well, let's take the best example, Texas. What about the government employees? Do you think that they suffered the way the rest of us suffered? What are your bets? Okay, James Quintero, down at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, actually knows the answer to this question. This is the kind of thing he keeps his eyes on. And he wrote it up for the Express News. It's titled Commentary. It's time for big government to get lean. And I loved this article. It made me so happy that we're talking about this because it's the perfect opportunity. So, James, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jackie, thanks for having me on. And I'm honored to have such an influential reader read over my little Express News op-ed. So thank you.
Of course. It was really exciting because you're talking about leaning down government. And, you know, the federal government has done some experimentation with this. And I've offered up some ideas on how to do that. And so I was very excited to see what you had in mind. So let's just start with my first question. When everyone is feeling all this pain, this clamped down pain, what was happening in Austin inside the state government agencies? I mean, are those employees relating to and feeling the pain the way that we are?
Well, there are some really eye-opening stats that were released a few weeks ago by the Texas Workforce Commission showing just the true extent of the economic damage that's been happening here in Texas. And as you've already pointed out, we have a 13% unemployment rate, which far exceeds the worst ever unemployment rate that was set back in 1986. Mm. And we have, just in April alone, we lost about 1.3 million jobs.
Wow.
And as you go, you begin to kind of parse through the data, what you see almost immediately is that most of those job losses were happening in the private sector. And these are massive year-over-year job losses, some reaching, for particular industries, almost 40% loss in workforce. And then you start looking at what's happening in government, and it's a little disconcerting to see that the public sector has only just barely felt any of the pain. Year over year, what you see is about a 0.4% decline in the public sector workforce.
Wow.
Less than 1%. Less than 1%. And, you know, in the past, the Texas Public Policy Foundation has really been at the forefront of calling for a reduction in the size and growth of government. But that message gets more urgent today because we're in the midst of an economic meltdown, and there's just not that private sector to support government girth today. We really need to right-size government to better match what's happening on the private in the private sector. And I think we have some opportunities coming up to do just that.
I think so, too, because, you know, I've worked in government at the state, local, and federal level. I've worked in a law firm. I've worked in a major bank, worked in a think tank, worked for myself in media. And one thing I've learned, it doesn't matter where you are, there are always people in the workplace who don't seem to really serve a purpose. And it's like almost every office, there are a handful of people who everyone else kind of wonders what it is they do all day. You know, what's going on over there in their cubicle? And no one knows. In government, you often cannot fire those people. It's very tough. So I'm of the opinion, and my former board of directors as well, every time that you cut staff, no one notices, right? These are like these big corporate guys, these CEOs, they're like, yeah, pretty much every time we make a 25% cut in staff, nobody really notices. And we were all left wondering, what did those people do all day? So I have to believe, James, that there's room for this, for cutting inside the government. And now is the perfect time. As you say, it's the private sector that supports the public sector, and the government policy just destroyed the private sector temporarily. So where do we start?
Great question. And you're absolutely right that there's been a lot of bureaucracy built up over the years. You know, as you and I well know, Texas has been one of the most prosperous states in the nation. And I give a lot of credit to the Texas legislature for doing their part to control spending, do what they can to reduce taxes, and generally keep the size of government manageable. And we've been the beneficiaries of that. What's been happening at the local level primarily is they've been adding a lot of bureaucracy to the system, and I think it's weighed down things quite a bit. And that's very evident as you look through their budgets and their finances. There's a lot of excess that's been built up over the years, and now is a very opportune time to really re-examine every position and every program to see whether or not it fulfills a function, a core function, right? You know, one of the things that we've been advising our friends, both at the local level as well as the state level, is let's invite some outside eyes to take a look at how things are running. There's this idea, there's this concept out there called a third-party efficiency audit. And basically, it's a very simple idea where you bring in a specialized auditor to take a look at your budget and operations, and again, bringing in some outside expertise to determine whether or not the money that's being spent actually serves a useful purpose. So this is not a bean counting exercise. We're not making sure that all the numbers line up. What we're really trying to do is determine whether or not taxpayers are getting the best bang for their buck, or whether that money ought to be shifted elsewhere in the budget, or maybe even just returned to taxpayers altogether.
Right.
There's some other states and localities out there that have done these third party efficiency audits to great effect. They're very useful, and I hope that my message doesn't fall on deaf ears.
We're talking with James Quintero down at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has a national initiative called Life Powered, which exists to raise America's energy IQ. Sometimes you ask me where I get all of the amazing information that you will not hear anywhere else but on this show. One of my primary sources is Life Powered, which you can find at lifepowered.org. Again, lifepowered.org. I have a steady stream of life-powered experts and content on this show each week because, just like my show, Life-Powered works to ensure that Americans continue to benefit from abundant, reliable, safe, and clean energy. Energy is the essential building block that touches all of our lives and influences everything from the world economy to our kitchen table. Energy fuels what is possible, the freedom to go where we want, live where we choose, and enjoy the things that we love most. Human flourishing depends on energy use, often in invisible and unnoticed ways. Reliable energy supply can feed the hungry, take care of the sick, and ensure a prosperous economic future for all of us. It promotes freedom and independence around the world and here at home. And fossil fuels don't just power your car and heat your home. They are the building blocks of 60% of all fibers and 100% of all plastics. They're used to create the fertilizers that produce food for half of the world. The U.S. has the means to lead the world in energy production. Through our ingenuity and innovation, responsible production of reliable energy will make the world safer, the environment cleaner, and each and every one of us more prosperous. If you want to know more about how this works, check it out, lifepowered.org. That's lifepowered.org. We'll take a break and we'll be right back. This is the Jackie Daly Show, and we're continuing a conversation with James Quintero down at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He's the policy director for the Government for the People campaign, and he's written up a great piece on how this is the perfect opportunity post-COVID shutdown to trim the size of government, because we simply don't have as much money as we used to. I mean, the taxpayer probably gets a bad return on investment all the time, no matter what, state, local, federal. But now more than ever, when we're down in revenues and the oil and gas industry, which supplies so much revenue to the state, has been decimated, we can't afford all of this government anymore. We were talking about audits before we left for break, where we actually have a second set of eyes come in, take a look at what's going on, and say, hey, does this make sense to spend this money? Are we getting our money's worth? I already am biased, James, about the answer to that question. I think we'd be a lot better off without as much government. I was thinking about the more money for example, federal Department of Education spends on education, the worse America's education scores are. I mean, there's so many examples where you're asking yourself, why are we doing this? And so my idea, and it wasn't an original idea, for Washington was, hey, why don't we take the agencies out of D.C., that glamorous Northwest or Northeast corridor, and send these agencies, like I want to send the Department of Homeland Security to Nacogdoches, Arizona, you know, high drug trafficking, high human trafficking, porous border. I want to put them at a very non-glamorous location in the center of the problem they're supposed to be fixing. And we would save money on real estate for the taxpayer and just get these folks into the real world. And probably a lot of them would just retire early, which would be amazing, right? Or send them to Minot, North Dakota, you know, average temperature negative 17, inhospitable. Maybe they'd retire. So the Department of the Interior has already moved out west, and other departments are being moved. And it's amazing this is actually happening under this president. My question is, would that be possible? Like, would that help at all for state government if we moved agencies out of Austin and placed them down in Brownsville or wherever so that they could be right in the middle of wherever their expertise is most needed?
Well, I absolutely love the concept. I think proximity to the problem absolutely matters. And I think you could actually save quite a bit of money in terms of real estate in Austin.
Yeah.
Perhaps compensation, employees as well. Because if you look at the Austin real estate market, it's one of the hottest in the nation. And I can guarantee you that the money that state taxpayers are paying to employ and retain a workforce is going to be much higher in Austin than it would be, say, elsewhere.
Right. You absolutely cannot justify it money-wise. And the fact is, you know, do we really need, is there a principled argument for why the majority of these employees need to be in Austin? You know, in the era of telecommuting, especially after COVID, so we have it proven to us, you can work from home and do an amazing job. Not everything. I mean, okay, if you work at the DMV, you need to be at the DMV. But for a lot of them, I think maybe Austin is not a requirement or necessity. What do you think?
No, I think you're absolutely on track. You know, that's one of the things that kind of excites me about this efficiency audit concept is, I'll be honest, I don't have all the answers when it comes to the places where particular agencies and local government should trim. But if you get somebody in there who's experienced with this technique and they're able to kind of open the hood and check the engine, they are able to have a very good idea of what it is that's working and what it is that's not. And so that's one of the things that I'm really excited about is getting this efficiency audit concept out there and moving in the local government realm. But that's not the only way that I think we can pare down the size of government. I think we have a whole host of different tools available to us that we ought to be employing, particularly given the state of the economy, right? As you and I discussed earlier, the private sector is not doing well, and the public sector needs to step up and shrink down so that we can begin healing. And some of the things that we've talked about at the foundation that we've been encouraging our friends in the state and local government side of things to do is to look at kind of these institution-wide hiring freezes. Let's tap the brakes on adding any new employees who are not absolutely essential. I think that's very important because as you look at state and local government budgets, what you see is that generally speaking, employees represented about 80 to 85% of the total cost of whatever that governmental entity is doing.
Ooh.
So employees are a big part of the equation here.
Yes.
I also think we ought to look at across the board pay compensation freezes, right? Let's ease the pressure again on the private sector. Another idea, let's pause travel for non-essential employees in training programs as well.
Yes.
This is really a time we need to watch every dollar that's being spent.
Well, and maybe the best and most exciting idea in there is you talk about reforming public pensions. I don't know how much time you need to cover that, but I've got 2.5 minutes left in this segment. What are you thinking?
Well, real quickly, I could probably bore your audience to death with public pension talk, but it's probably one of the most important yet least understood issues that exist in public policy. We have a very serious public pension crisis that's developing here in Texas, largely due to the fact that we rely heavily on a defined benefit system that promises every retiree, every eligible retiree that is, an annuity in perpetuity that's calculated based on their years of service and pay. And so what we're doing is we're making promises to folks without knowing whether or not we have the money to back it up, and that is causing a lot of problems.
Yeah, and this seems to be a problem state after state after state. Is there any state that has its pension in order? I only hear about states that don't.
If there is, I'm not aware of it. but I'll tell you, there's when it comes to public pension reform, it's one of the most difficult issues out there because you have too few people who understand the true financial commitment that's being made.
Right.
And you have, on the other side, a lot of vested interests who refuse to give anything and fight tooth and nail to keep all of the generous benefits that they've won over the years. It's a kind of a lopsided equation. And unfortunately, what I've seen in my experience is that it oftentimes takes a fiscal crisis to really make any kind of significant reform, which is very unfortunate because you're putting both taxpayers and retirees on the line when you do that.
Well, I will tell you that I made a suggestion to some friends of ours in Washington that there should be an audit of federal ERISA-compliant pensions just to see if they were investing in, like, green funds and losing mm-hmm. money instead of, like, traditional energy and divesting mm-hmm. from traditional and losing money. And the president actually put that into an executive order that there will be an audit of ERISA-compliant funds. It should be done any day now. I have no idea if my whispering in the ears of people who could help had anything to do with it, but I'm very happy it's happening. And so the idea was that he would establish what constitutes a breach of fiduciary duty when you're investing in, charity or aspirational experimental investments, as opposed to tried and true investments that make a return for the pensioner. So the pensioners should be with us on this one. I don't know. We're talking with James Quintero, and he's down at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, talking about his piece that you can see online. It's titled Commentary, It's Time for Big Government to Get Lean. That's in expressnews.com. James, thanks so much for being with us.
Jackie, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Anytime. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show.